Hello, everybody. I'm Dennis Prager. Welcome to my home. This is actually my home. This is completely unscripted. It is my almost weekly fireside chat because it's a good way to get to know each other, and especially you to know me, because, you know, if you see me on one of the videos, obviously, it's something I read from what I wrote. So it's me, but I wrote it. But there's nothing written here. And it's a good chance for me to also talk about a lot of non-political things, because my radio show, obviously, is not only about that, but has to be on what's in the news, as well as the other things that I care about. Anyway, whatever the reason, I'm glad you're watching. A lot of people do, and I'm very happy about it. Welcome again to my home. So I'm going to be really personal in the opening thoughts of this week, because this has been a very powerful and personally moving week for me. Since I was a kid, and I mean about high school, I had a dream of taking the insights of the Bible to the world, because I had a very early belief that there was great wisdom and great moral guidance here, and that people, even religious people, didn't truly appreciate how wonderful it was, and especially the first five books of the Bible, which are called, among Jews, the Torah. Many non-Jews know the word too, but that has a special ranking. And so I've devoted my life, obviously not on the radio and not anywhere else, but in courses and on video, but there was no internet when I began. So for 18 years, I taught verse by verse the first five books of the Bible, the Torah. And half the people who came to the class were not Jewish, even though it was at a Jewish university. And the reason was very simple. I have a motto. Either the Torah has something to say to everybody, or it has nothing to say to the Jews. The idea that it only speaks to Jews is absurd. It's like saying, and I think I've given this analogy, only vitamin C is only good for Baptists. I mean, it's an absurdity. Either it's good for Baptists, or it's good for everybody, or it's not good for anybody. So this has been the source of my understanding of life. And if you think that I have a good understanding of life, then you might want to know where I got it from. And I largely got it from these five books, from the Bible generally, but especially these five books. So finally, thanks to a dear friend's incredible efforts in making this happen, the first volume of my five-volume commentary has just come out this week, and it's called The Rational Bible, and because the reason is that I use reason alone. Reason is my vehicle to God and to religion. So I don't ask anybody to suspend their faculty of reason in what I have to say in this book. But why this week was particularly moving was not just because it was published, and it's beautifully done. Regnery, the publisher, did it. I mean, a staggeringly beautiful job. It's in two colors. It's extremely accessible in the way it's presented as well. But I was shocked this week, and it's rare in life you get a pleasant shock. Most shocks are not pleasant, but I got a pleasant shock. The book was the second best-selling book in the United States on Amazon, and the first number one in nonfiction. I didn't even imagine, you know, sometimes you have an imagination of something wonderful happening. I never even imagined it. Part of the reason is, by the way, as you'll find in my happiness book, I don't have expectations in life. So I'm constantly placed in a position of being grateful for what happens, because I expect nothing. So if something good happens, woo-hoo-hoo. But this is beyond that. And it tells me a lot of things, but the thing it most tells me is there's a hunger in this radically secularized Western world in which we live. Essentially a godless world in which many of you have been raised, for something deeper and transcendent. And it makes sense. Do you know that this, you are, if you're under 50, let alone under 35 or under 20, you're the first generation in history that was raised in essentially a godless world. Your education was godless, the society around you, the entertainment world. But America was not. America was a deeply Bible-based country. And that's why it became the greatest country that it did. And for those of you who are not American, I'm not saying this because I'm American. I'm not a chauvinist. None of that stuff matters to me. Anybody could be wonderful in any country, and there are plenty of miserable Americans, and we all know that, and that's not the issue. But it became the country where, when France gave a Statue of Liberty, they didn't give it to another country. They gave it to the United States because we stood for liberty. And the founders of America were deeply rooted in this book. The most famous symbol of the American Revolution, by far, there is really no other symbol. This is the symbol. It's called the Liberty Bell. There's only one thing written on the Liberty Bell, and it's a verse from the Bible, from the Torah, from the third book, Leviticus. You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. And they got the idea that God wants us to be free from these books, from this Bible, and especially from this Torah, these first five books. They were so immersed in it that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, two of the founders of the United States of America, Jefferson became president. Franklin was the best-known American outside of the United States. They designed a seal of the United States, the Great Seal of the United States. You could see it on the internet. You know what it was? It was the Exodus, the Jews leaving Egypt. Because they said, just as the Jews left Egypt, we left Europe to be free. That is how powerful these ideas were in these founders. And now you are raised. I bet most young people today, I'll bet most the kids at Stanford, Yale, you name it, doesn't matter where, could not identify Cain and Abel. I'll bet a lot of you can't. This was unheard of. I promise you, 98% of Americans 100 years ago would have not only identified Cain and Abel, they would have told you the entire story. The Bible was the one book, if a family in America had a book, it was the Bible. Abraham Lincoln, the great president, the emancipator of slaves, Abraham Lincoln had one book on his nightstand, and he said he read it every single night. He didn't go to church almost ever, but he read this book, the Bible, every night. What you don't get in college or high school or elementary school now is wisdom. Wisdom matters. Wisdom is much more important than knowledge. They're not the same thing. Wisdom is what is life about? Which reminds me, I said something on the radio yesterday that I actually liked, so I committed it to memory. A lot of people say, oh, we don't need religion. Well, science will guide us. That is so unbelievably foolish. And I said the following on the radio yesterday. I said, science is a moral idiot. It is. Science doesn't tell you right from wrong. Science is completely oblivious to whether you murder, rape, torture. It doesn't matter. Science doesn't care. Science doesn't teach you right from wrong. It teaches you what atoms compose a water molecule. That's very important. Science is great if it's used for good things. It could be used for horrific things, obviously. It's completely morally neutral. Science can't replace religion. Religion tells you what is right and wrong. Science tells you what is. That's not the same thing. What is and what is right and wrong are not the same thing. What teaches you what is right and wrong? What teaches you the meaning of life? Not science. It's not science's fault. It's like asking a barracuda to drive you to work. Barracudas don't drive. Just the way it is. Is that right, Noah? Because you get driven a lot. Never been driven by a barracuda.
Not yet.
Not yet? Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I need my lighter. Oh, my God. Help, help, help. Okay. Anyway, that's very important. Next time you hear science, 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 science is great. All right? You're not going to get a cure for cancer from the Bible. I agree. But you're not going to get right and wrong from science. You're not going to get what is the purpose of life from science. Science doesn't tell you anything about that. There's no wisdom in science. There's knowledge in science. Okay? So this is why this is so important. This is why I hope you will read this, because it's meant to change your life. It's not meant to convert you to anything. I'm not asking people to convert to Judaism or to Christianity or even to faith in God. Just read it. You decide what you want to do with your life. But it's got a lot of stuff in here that will help your life. So, it's what it is, the Rational Bible. And I really do hope, I hope you'll read it. Because we're in trouble. That's why we're in trouble. We've lost our way in many ways. Okay, those are some thoughts. Now to your questions. All right, question time. Owner. I always get this. Owner. If I press it again. Okay, I got it. Stephanie, 29, in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Stephanie. Do you have any advice for a person who keeps wavering on religion? How do you find a constant faith in God? Is it just supposed to come naturally? Doesn't come to me naturally. That's why I spend so much time teaching this stuff. This is why the approach of most religious people has not been my approach. You know, have faith, have faith, have faith. I never have said that once to people. Here are reasons to take God seriously. Reasons. Not faith, 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 faith. Faith is nice. But reason is powerful. So that's why I call it the Rational Bible. That is my approach. What is the other part of your question? One second. Did we get rid of it? Yeah, we did. Got back. God, what magic. Wow. Do you have any advice for a person who keeps wavering on religion? Everybody wavers. The only people who don't waver are atheists. Every person who believes wavers. When I see or hear about a baby born with terrible deformities, you don't think I ask, where is God? Of course I do. Every thinking religious person wavers. Here's something that I'm preparing the next book on Genesis coming out next year. This is Exodus, the second book. The first book is Genesis. Do you know the name Israel, which is the name of the Hebrew people or the Jewish people? In the Bible, the man named Jacob has his name changed to Israel. That's where we get Israel from. The children of Israel are the Hebrews or the Jews. You know what Israel means? It says so in the book. I didn't make this up. Struggle with God. Yisra'el. El is God. Yisra is to struggle with. Isn't that amazing? The name of, so to speak, God's people is struggle with God. It is completely okay to struggle with God. What is not okay is not to struggle, is to be an atheist. Or to be an agnostic and say it doesn't matter. It matters. So struggling with God is completely understandable. We struggle with everything meaningful. Most people struggle with their parents. Right? I mean, just it's not a perfect analogy. What struggle is part of life. Sometimes husbands and wives struggle. I mean, I read about it somewhere. In my own diary. Okay, all right, a little dark humor there. Okay, I've been divorced, but I'm very happily married now, thank God. All right, let's see here. Where are we? Okay. Anna, 26, Long Island, New York. Hi, Dennis. Hi, Anna. I'm newly engaged. For context, we both love your work and are conservative and Catholic. Hi again. What would be the most important lesson to carry forward into our marriage? Oh, man. You know what? First of all, you should read. Well, you're married already. Those of you not married should read. It's on the internet somewhere. It's easy to find. Just put in Dennis Prager, questions to ask before you marry. And it's a two-part column that I wrote many years ago, questions people should ask. I told you it's in my house. I even know which dog that is. He barks if there is a mosquito that flies by. I mean, anyway, he's a basset hound. That's what they're known for. You should read that. It's got questions that people should ask before they get married. Now that you're married, does it say you're engaged? Oh, yes. Read this. That's right. This is perfect. It's for you. questions you should ask before you marry. And it'll help you, it'll either solidify your engagement or end it. I got a fair number of emails from people who ended their relationships before marriage because of the answers that they gave to these questions. So there's a lot to go forward. What else did you ask? Let's see. Most important lesson to carry forward into our marriage. You know what? There is no most important. There are many. First of all, you should share values. Obviously, there should be chemistry. Here, you ready? See, I'm always wondering, because are there little kids who watch this? Because I have to, you know, I have adult themes. I don't have bad language, but I have adult themes. I think people should marry if they, three things have to be involved in your commitment or your desire, your attraction to this other person. Your brain, your heart, and your sexual parts. They don't have to be 30, 30, 30, or 33, 33, 33, to be more precise. No, but they all have to be there. It could be 50, 30, 20. That's fine. But it can't. None of them can be zero or next to zero. That all three have to be involved in helping to create a good marriage. That's one thing. Sharing values is another. But here is my favorite question when I meet people. My favorite question is, what cigar do you smoke? Nope, my favorite question is, do you enjoy each other? That's a big one. You can love each other and not enjoy each other. That's a very important part of life. Do you enjoy, by the way, same with friends. Do you enjoy your friends? So it's a big deal. It's not the only deal, but it should be there. So good luck. All right, Jack, 17, Manhattan Beach, California, Prager Force. Thank you, Jack. What are your thoughts on the recent Palestinian, quote, peace, unquote, protests? Who was to blame for the, quote, unquote, nonviolent, unquote, violence? Well, look, Hamas wants to destroy Israel. It's not an opinion. This is they live for that. It's most Westerners cannot understand this, that among Palestinians and many other Muslims, tragically, in the Middle East in particular, and not just the Middle East, Iran is not necessarily the Middle East, the most powerful idea of their life, the animating focus of their existence, is to annihilate Israel. Most people in the West are, this is so foreign to their mentality that they can't relate to it. You mean you live to destroy another country? That's right. That's what they live for. Hamas is completely uninterested in building hospitals, in employing its youth, in building schools. It has no interest. It has one interest: annihilate Israel. That is the only interest of Hezbollah in Lebanon. That is the only interest of many Palestinians. It is the only interest of the Iranian regime. That everything else is secondary in life. There is no parallel to that in the world, that people are animated by a desire to destroy a country. Israel is the only country on earth targeted for annihilation. Got to think, by the way, that in and of itself is an interesting question. Why? There's only one Jewish country on earth, and it's the only country targeted for annihilation. Read my book, Why the Jews? It explains that, but that's another issue. Okie doke. Finally, Jonathan, 18, in California. He has no city. California is very big. Just said California. Amidst all the political talk and work, what do you do to stay level and maintain joy in a profession often associated with negativity? Well, actually, it is work. My book on happiness, and I hate sounding like I'm a promoter of my books. But what am I going to do? I did write them. I'm not going to deny it. But I worked very hard on the issue of happiness. 1 hour of my show every week since 1999 is called the Happiness Hour. I lecture on happiness. I've given this a lot of serious thought. the founders of America, in their genius, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's in the Declaration of Independence. So I don't know if any other country has pursuit of happiness in its founding document. This is something I love, one of the many things I love about the founders of this country. It's good to pursue happiness. It's not good to pursue fun. It's not good to pursue excitement, but it is good to pursue happiness. So, and it's an art. There is an art to being happy. It's a tough world we live in. And in my profession, you're 100% right. Every day I'm reading about terrible things in America and in the world. And I work to maintain a happy disposition. I do. So I look for happiness outside of the newspaper. I don't find it there. And anyway, if I get down, what good will it do? It's not going to do my listeners any good. It's not going to do me any good. It's not going to do my family any good. That's why I think we have a moral obligation to have a happy disposition. It brings joy to others. By the way, if you have a happy disposition, you bring people into your life. Do you know a lot of people have no friends? This was a revelation to me since I've always had close male friends. It's been a revelation to me, but I learned it through my radio show. How many people call up and say, Dennis, I just don't have any friends. And I was talking to my friend, Dr. Stephen Marmer, who's a psychiatrist at UCLA and in private practice in LA. Brilliant man, a good man. And he pointed out there's a correlation. Happy people tend to have friends. So there's a selfish reason for you to pursue happiness. You'll probably draw more people into your life. So it's a vicious cycle. This is how life works. It's cycles. Life is filled with cycles. Happy people bring friends into their lives. Friends bring you happiness. So you get more happy and get more friends, and more friends and more happy. Unhappy people tend not to attract people. Then the fewer friends they have, the more unhappy they get. The more unhappy they get, the fewer friends they have. So it's another reason to have a happy disposition and to work on it. So I work on it, but you're right. And the most depressing part is when I see what's happening in America and I see what's happening at our universities, the closed-mindedness and the ease with which people just call people horrible names. You know, I'm going to be speaking at Columbia University next week. On what day will I be there? Because I'm going to be in Philadelphia.
Wednesday.
I'm going to be in New York. I'm going to be in North Carolina. Wednesday? So Wednesday, I'm speaking at Columbia University, where I attended graduate school. It's the first time I'm going back, I think. I don't remember. Maybe I went back once. I don't remember. And there's such a battle to get a place for me to speak because I'm conservative. So all this hate, these hate-filled students and teachers just protest if a conservative comes. These are bad trends in America. Call people you differ with fascists and white supremacists and neo-Nazis. All it does is cheapen the battle against real neo-Nazis. That's what it does. So anyway, yep, I work on it. It's a very valid question. How are we doing on time, everybody? Pretty much, what? What? How much time have we been on? How long? Nobody knows? I have three wonderful, bright people here. I told them, let me know when it's a half hour, and nobody knows how much time it is yet. Anyway, I don't want to overburden you with time. We have five to go till we hit 30 minutes. So I think, yes? All right, I'm getting mixed signals. Okay, this is really funny. This proves it's not scripted. This is so not elegant. This is so unsophisticated. It could only be unscripted. Be that as it may, look, I gave you a lot of heavy-duty stuff to think about. These fireside chats mean a lot to me. That's why with all the things I'm doing, I try not to miss them. So until next week, please do read my book, The Rational Bible. I promise it'll affect your life. It's the outpouring of what I've thought through for all of my life, and it's important in an age where meaning is at a premium. And I'll see you next week. And those of you at Columbia, I'll see you, I hope, Wednesday. And until then, thank you so much for watching. I'm Dennis Prager. Bye-bye.